Okay, the date is July 14th, 1987. I'm in Professor Richard Miller's office in the School of Business. And do I have your permission to interview you?
Yes, you do.
Okay. I wanted to start out by you giving us a little background, how you came to Cornell, how you came to Wisconsin. And just a brief overview of your endeavors here before you became director of the Institute.
Oh, well, I'm glad to do this, Amy. It's going to take a little bit of digging to bring all of this back, but let me see if I can begin at the beginning, a la Snoopy style here. I arrived the fall of 1966. Had been the previous year at the University of Buffalo as an assistant professor in the Department of Industrial Relations. And for a couple of years before that, working on my PhD at Cornell University. And I did my dissertation research in Mexico, looking at Mexican unions and economic development. And while I was there, I met a fellow by the name of Bill Glade, who was then on the faculty at the University of Wisconsin. And so, in a chance conversation with Glade in Mexico, he suggested that the University of Wisconsin was doing some interesting things in the area of economic development and industrial relations, that in addition to what was going on in the economics department and the business school, there was also an industrial relations program. So when we parted company in the spring of 1985, and I went off to the University of Buffalo, he came on to Wisconsin, invited me out during the spring of 1966, and that led to my leaving Buffalo and coming to Wisconsin in the fall of 1966. The time that I came to Wisconsin, I was primarily interested in international industrial relations. I had spent some time in Cuba in the early 1950s, some time in Mexico and other parts of Latin America. And so that my focus at that point was pretty much Latin America, economic development, and particularly issues related to collective bargaining. My first couple of years here, in fact, I taught jointly between the Latin American Studies program and the School of Business, as well as dabbled in industrial relations. I covered such courses as economic development of Latin America, international business, and international industrial relations. As my relationship with the Industrial Relations Research Institute developed, I was offered an opportunity in the fall of 1968 to become the assistant director of the IR program. At the time, Jerry Summers was the director, and I went through a transition period in which Jim Stern took over from Jerry Summers. And Jim and I and Jerry began a massive revision of the industrial relations curriculum, and with other people such as Jack Barbash, sort of launched it into a whole new era. For example, when I arrived, the Industrial Relations Institute had gone through a name change. It had been the Industrial Relations Center. It offered a master's degree and a PhD that had some 8 majors and minors, and a not a sense of cohesion in any of the programs. People were studying personnel administration as majors, were studying collective bargaining as majors, were studying labor history as majors, and we wanted to try to integrate the curriculum so that there would be some cohesion to it, that people would first of all be industrial relations students, and then secondly would be working in some area of concentration. So that in part because I'd recently gone through the Cornell program and used that as a role model, we launched the four major areas of manpower, organizational behavior and personnel, collective bargaining, and then the fourth is international industrial relations, with the expectation that students would be required to do work in each of the four fields, would do work in industrial relations theory, and would do work in industrial relations research methods, so that was well underway in the late 1960s, and I think had its initial mark on the major group of graduate students that we had at that time. Tom Kokin, Myron Rumpkin, Jim Marchetti, Carl Schramm, and a number of others, so that it put what we hoped would be a very special mark, identified the industrial relations students and their program, so that it was more than just a collection of courses drawn from various departments. So that Jim Stern and I worked together for 2 years, and then in 1970, I think, Jim and I both decided that we'd had enough of the program for a while. Jim went to the University of Warwick for a year, and I went to the University of Texas, again primarily in the Latin American area, with a joint appointment in the Industrial Relations Institute there, as well as School of Business. And so that I was, Jim and I should say, both were followed, I think, by Jim Jones, who became the director in 70 or in 70. And then after I had come back in 71, Jim Jones let's see. At any rate, Jim was the interim director for a number of years after Stern and I had left the administration of the Institute, and while we were away. I took over as a director in 1973, and continued in that position until 1977.
Can you tell me a little bit about the selection process at the time? Or I know that in some cases it was, and I'm not sure if it was the case here, where the executive, the director of the previous director, formed a search committee and decided on, put up some names and then made a recommendation, and the recommendation was either accepted or rejected. Was that the case?
Yes, that was pretty much the case. I can't remember what had gone on before then. But both in the case of Jim Jones, and then when I was appointed in 1973, the executive committee of the Institute, created a search and screen committee for the directorship. And then on the basis of their recommendation to the executive committee and the Dean of Letters and Science, I was appointed as Jim Jones and virtually every other director since that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So that there was a formal process and a series of consultations that went on. The executive committee ultimately votes on the recommendations made by the search and screen committee, which is then subject to the approval of the Dean of Letters and Science.
Mm-hmm.
So that process was followed when I was appointed director. It was followed also with the appointment of the associate director at that point, who was Harry Graham.
Mm-hmm.
Both my appointment and Harry Graham's appointment were efforts to bridge the diverse departments.
He was from...
Harry Graham at that time was a member of the faculty of the School for Workers, was
mm-hmm.
a professor in the School for Workers in the Extension Division. And so that because the relationship with the School for Workers was very important to us, then his appointment was an effort to sort of solidify that
mm-hmm.
relationship. I believe that I was the first non-economics professor appointed to the directorship. Alan Philly had been Jerry Summers' associate director at one point, but up until 1973, all the previous directors, I think, had been members of the economics department in one way
mm-hmm.
or another, although it might have been a tenuous relationship, as in the case of Robin Fleming, but
mm-hmm.
but I'm not sure about that.
Mm-hmm. Now, was the when you were director, was the center located, where the institute, was it located where it is now, in terms of the physical space?
Yes. The physical space had not changed very much. In the intervening time between when I had been the associate director and Jim Jones had taken over, the institute had moved out of, I believe, 4226 Social Science offices directly across the way from the present offices, and so that the departmental secretary and another secretary used the outer office for that suite, and then the director's office and the meetings and so forth were all held in the back office.
Mm-hmm.
But the area was very cramped.
Mm-hmm.
Only a few people could come in for meetings. There was a lot of noise from the loading dock. It was not properly air conditioned. And so that the executive committee sought additional space.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, I think in what had been an old library facility, moved across the way, had some rebuilding done. And had more space to work with. There
mm-hmm.
there were also, there was an area called the student lab, which was remodeled at that time, divided up into smaller offices from the sort of huge bullpen it had been.
Mm-hmm.
And there were other offices spread around the building, two or three offices on the main floor where the publications office is now and next to it, and some others up on the sixth floor,
mm-hmm.
most of which have since been lost
mm-hmm.
or taken back by the university.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You mentioned the nomination or Harry Graham serving as associate director as an effort to kind of bridge the gap between departments and get a more coordinated effort around your activities. And I wonder what the relations were during your tenure with the Department of Economics, and I'm not sure whether this was called the business school at the time or the School of Commerce still. But in any case, whether what types of conflicts or areas of agreement and cooperation that you had with these two departments?
Well, the relationships were mixed with those departments, as well as with other departments that played a part in the Institute's activities, including the Sociology Department and the School for Workers. They were mixed in the following sense, that the Economics Department had always been the predominant department in the life of the Institute, had had the largest number of members, had been the sort of dominant force on the executive committee, had in many respects, the Institute had been identified as a sub-department of the Economics Department. So the connections with the Economics Department were strong through the IR contingent, the people such as Jerry Summers, Jim Stern, Jack Barbash, Dave Johnson, Ed Young, and a couple of others. And they provided teaching manpower for many of the courses. They hired numbers of students, served on the committees, and so that until that point and for some time after, the Economics Department was the nucleus of the Institute.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, in a sense, a sort of enclave in the Economics Department, somewhat isolated beachhead,
mm-hmm.
that whose perimeter, in a sense, got smaller as the years went by. It got smaller in part for the reason that the Economics Department itself went through a philosophical and organizational change, transition, that institutional economics, applied economics, became much less important in the scheme of things in economics as econometrics and econ theory became the dominant areas in economics, and so at one point, in fact, the economics chairman had, for the most part, been selected from IR faculty, IR econ faculty members, such as Ed Young and Jerry Summers and,
mm-hmm.
and others, which tended to solidify the gap, solidify the connection.
Mm-hmm.
But as the trends in economics changed, then the connections weakened. Other individuals came along as chairman and dominant faculty members who were less sympathetic about the needs of industrial relations. And it became a concern that the economics IR faculty was getting older,
mm-hmm.
Perhaps less engaged in research,
mm-hmm.
And there was a possibility that as they retired or left the department that they would not be replaced,
mm-hmm.
And that we would gradually lose our connection with economics, so that in recent years the connection with economics has been more tenuous, although it's still been strong. I don't want to say that it's been weakened to the point that that it was no longer viable, because certainly that's not been the case. Lee Hansen and Jim Stern particularly have made that connection work. But the concern, at any rate, that the connection at some point would be severed, has been there for the last 20 years and was exacerbated with the untimely death of Jerry Summers, who'd been a very major force in maintaining the connection. So that mixed in the sense that the Institute began to drift away from economics, away, in fact, from the disciplines that had been the main building blocks for the program. In a converse sense, somewhat the opposite has happened with the School of Business. In the beginning, there was a much more tenuous relationship. A few faculty who were active in the Institute's activities, who supported its programs, but looked on the programs quite narrowly. Among the earlier business school faculty, for example, were George Strother and Alton Johnson, and who saw a role for the Institute, but whose interest mainly sort of overlapped in some respects, particularly through the personnel area with the industrial relations programs. The main connection until the mid-1960s had been Alton Johnson, George Strother, and then Al Philly. And I suppose when I was hired primarily with an appointment in the business school coming out of Cornell with what was more of a classic IR graduate background, then there was a greater opportunity to make some connections, because I looked upon my home as IR as much as any place on campus. Didn't see myself as a personnel type or a specialist in organizational behavior or really any of the areas of management, although I had an undergraduate degree in business. Really had sort of very little intellectual or philosophical orientation towards business as either a field of work or a field of study. To the extent that there were other areas beyond industrial relations I was interested in, that was economic development, Latin American studies, and international industrial relations. So that I wasted no time in trying to make a connection with industrial relations, and as the opportunities presented themselves, probably spent as much or more time with industrial relations students and industrial relations activities as I did anywhere on campus, and the opportunity to become the assistant or associate director, I guess it was, in 1968, then really sort of heightened or improved, increased those opportunities. But my connection through the business school with industrial relations also then got greatly supported through my home department in the business school, the management department, with the hiring of Don Schwab, 1966-67, who came out of the industrial relations program at Minnesota, and who shared a good deal of my interest in industrial relations. And then also by the business school's hiring of Herb Hieneman, who was was coming out of, was one of our own students in industrial relations, was one of a student for whom Don Schwab had been the major professor, and who saw himself in those days primarily as an industrial relations sort of specialist. So that from the latter part of the 1960s onwards, then the connections with the business school grew rapidly, and increased in a number of different ways. Business school became more active in all hiring students as IR students, as RAs and TAs. Business school management department faculty serving as advisors, major professors serving on committees. And so that by the early 1970s, there was probably as much business school participation in the Institute as there was economics.
Mm-hmm. How does that feed into the quest for departmentalization in terms of an impression I get from reading the material of that era that there were real staffing problems in terms of teaching IR specific courses. Was that a function of the move away from the economics department and their unwillingness or inability due to maybe budget constraints to teach these basic courses?
Well, let me pick that question up. It's a relevant question, good question, and I want to pick it up in this way. I'd mentioned before that it was a mixed relationship with the business school, although as well as the economics department, although a relationship that tended to go somewhat in the opposite direction over the years than the relationship with economics did, in much the same fashion that the labor econ people were an enclave in the business school. The IR business school people also were an enclave in the business school.
Mm-hmm.
And so that while there was a good deal of support in the business school through the management department, this support was not reciprocated by other business school departments. There were individuals and also departments who looked askance
mm-hmm.
at working with industrial relations, working with economics, working with letters and science. And some of them saw the industrial relations program as primarily a labor-oriented program.
Mm-hmm.
They saw it identified, for example, with at one point with the Teaching Assistants Association, with the sort of student dissent, student activism in the late 60s into the 70s, and so they saw it as a sort of radical group of people.
Mm-hmm.
And the nature of a number of the management department people was such that it didn't allay these feelings that we didn't quite fit the mold at the business school.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't, and in that sense, our sort of negative image carried over to the industrial relations, or at least they sort of reinforced each other. So
mm-hmm.
the dean of the business school in those days, and as he was followed a man by the name of Gomnitz first, and then Bob Bach, were at best lukewarm towards
mm-hmm.
the Institute. And people who, in the business school, who worked in the Institute, in a sense, were not encouraged to do that, not rewarded in terms of salary increases, for example, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that there was both a predisposition towards departmentalization
mm-hmm.
that came from people such as myself, who'd been brought up in the Cornell order of things, a separate department, a school of industrial relations, its own faculty, its own budgets, its own students, its own facilities, who were somewhat, well,
mm-hmm.
Somewhat taken aback, somewhat discomfited, to arrive at Wisconsin, a program that had this long tradition, John R. Commons and Perlman, and all of this, had a very strong national and international reputation, yet seemed to be a shell that really had no visible substance to it,
mm-hmm.
no physical presence, a scattered faculty drawn from various departments, a sort of hole-in-the-wall office, a minuscule budget in which each year was somewhat more precarious than the next,
mm-hmm.
and the finding that the institute itself was not really encouraged by these home departments to any great extent. The departments such as economics beginning to withdraw their support, the prospect that the core faculty would be gone from the institute, and the likelihood small that they would be replaced, that precipitated an effort on the part of some of the faculty then to in a sense, administratively or organizationally
mm-hmm.
establish the institute as a full-fledged department. Full-fledged in the sense that it not only would have, as it did then, a degree program, it would not only have its own students, it would not only have its own budget,
mm-hmm.
But it would also, most importantly, have a tenure track,
mm-hmm.
the right to appoint its own faculty to the institute as a home base, and not be required, as it was then and is now, to go to the departments and ask them to support the institute in recruiting efforts, not be required to go and seek the approval of various participating departments
mm-hmm.
for the appointment of joint faculty. As it stood then and it does now, no individual could be appointed to the industrial relations budget as a faculty member for more than 50%, and their home has to be in campus departments such as economics, sociology, or business. And as we looked at this situation, projected where we would be perhaps 5 years, 10 years, it was not a very pleasing prospect. It appeared as though the institute itself would conceivably go out of business. And so in the early 1970s then, we looked at a number of different programs. We set up a formal committee,
mm-hmm.
And then drew up what we hoped would be, in essence, a prospectus that would justify why we needed to be a separate Department of Industrial Relations. The department would have continued as a unit of the College of Letters and Science, although there was some discussion of locating it elsewhere, for example, within the business school. Some concern with what budgetary requirement would be necessary,
mm-hmm.
How many faculty might be required, and so forth. The committee, working with the executive committee of the institute, then drew up a proposal which was submitted eventually to the Dean of Letters and Science. The hope was, I should say that there were a number of steps that were required before this could ever eventuate. It had to be approved by the executive committee of the institute. If approved, it then went to the Dean of Letters and Science, who would set up a committee to consider this and make recommendations, which ultimately was done. If it had been approved at that level, it then would have gone to the faculty senate for the College of Letters and Science.
Mm-hmm.
From there, it would have gone to an academic planning committee for the Madison campus, and from there to the Madison campus senate. If approved, from there it would have gone to university system-wide administration, from there to the Board of Regents, and ultimately to the president of the system, and so forth. So that it was a very complex and time-consuming process. The main hurdle, well, there were two main hurdles that developed eventually that made it impossible to get it beyond the level of the College of Letters and Science. One was a division of opinion within the faculty of the institute. The participating faculty and the executive committee were not unanimous in their endorsement of this, although there was enough support to have a majority in favor. The second hurdle was at the level of the Dean of the College of Letters and Science.
Mm-hmm.
The Dean set up a committee that met with myself, that met with me and several other individuals appointed by the executive committee of the institute, received our documents, and then ultimately made a recommendation to the Dean of LNS that other means be sought beyond departmentalization. Acknowledged budgetary problems, acknowledged faculty replacement problems, but concluded that that the institute could apparently continue to function on the basis that it had,
mm-hmm.
that efforts should be made to work with the departments such as economics, and that the Dean of LNS would also attempt to cooperate to make the present system work, that only if all of these other options failed would they then consider departmentalization of the institute. And it was my understanding that the Dean of LNS looked upon his service as the director of the of a center dealing with humanities, and as well his relationship with the Institute for Environmental Studies, and decided that there were already too many of these programs, that departmentalization was not the route to go with them. It resulted in a proliferation of departments, that the emphasis should be on the so-called regular departments, established disciplines. And so that the effort at that point to departmentalize was unsuccessful.
How much did the general contraction of the university budget around that time have to do have influence on the dean's decision, do you think, in terms of spreading the wealth?
Well, I can't speak for the dean, and so I don't know for certain. I can only speculate, but My impression is that it played a role, that the university was under great economic pressure, that particularly the College of Letters and Science was undergoing a great deal of budgetary contraction, that it was engaged in a sort of zero-sum game,
mm-hmm.
Robbing Peter to pay Paul,
mm-hmm.
and that the creation of an industrial relations department would have been another claimant beyond the claims it was already making for scarce funds.
Mm-hmm.
And hence, perhaps with some justification, there was an emphasis placed on greater cooperative efforts, pooling of resources, and not the stimulation of new demands that the dean could not justify in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was also an intellectual and philosophical basis that reinforced the
mm-hmm.
budgetary issues.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the general mentality of the period, in fact, did carry through to departments such as economics and sociology, which became opposed
mm-hmm.
to the departmentalization of the Institute, partly on economic grounds.
Mm-hmm.
That however small the Institute was and however minuscule its budget, it was still another rival
mm-hmm.
for scarce funds. And so, again, the emphasis was cooperation and pooling of resources, but it meant further sort of immiserization of the Institute, greater necessity to go cap in hand
mm-hmm.
To the dean and to the other departments and plead for continued support or some support.
Mm-hmm.
So that there were a combination of factors that doomed the effort. But I think that it should be clear also that within the faculty itself, as I suggested, there was a division of opinion that
mm-hmm.
still exists.
Mm-hmm.
Strong feeling in economics among some of the participating faculty, Bob Lampman, for example, who did not see the Cornell ILR program as an appropriate model,
mm-hmm.
who thought that departmentalization would result in a duplication of faculty of a second-rate program,
mm.
in which there would be economics professors who were not top-notch teaching in economics.
Mm-hmm.
There would be IR sociologists who were second-rate sociologists. There would be IR lawyers, this would lower the quality of the program and burn the bridges with the departments, and many of the faculty believed then and are still persuaded today that great strength of the program was the ability to draw on the departments,
mm-hmm.
and in turn to the program to avail itself of the strengths of these departments, the very best people in the departments,
mm-hmm.
and not sort of stockpile a duplicate second-rate
mm-hmm.
faculty. Lampman had been particularly unimpressed by the time that he spent at Cornell and the people he found there.
Mm-hmm.
Bob, I hope you'll forgive me for putting words in his mouth, but this was my
mm-hmm.
understanding of it.
Mm-hmm.
I was told, and this is hearsay, that one economics professor, during the course of the debates over departmentalization, described an IR department as sort of akin to being the let's see, how is it put? Well, I think maybe I'll let that one pass.
Okay.
One of my colleagues, I'm sure, will raise this if he hasn't already.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, there was not a consensus, and is not today a consensus, among IR faculty in economics, business school, or sociology, to the effect that departmentalization is an appropriate route to go. And I think, if anything, that feeling has grown.
Mm-hmm.
That it would be more difficult now to get an agreement to go to the dean of LNS and reopen the whole departmentalization issue.
I'm going to turn on the tape now, but just about out. I wanted to I guess ask you about the role that IR has now of reviewing the candidates for tenure of the other departments. Those that have involvement or will have a joint appointment from to IR and the department, the major department. Was this part of this compromise or this offering in lieu of departmentalization, or was that part of the process before?
No, it's part of the process that's existed ever since I've been here, that to the extent that an individual has some proportion of his or her appointment in industrial relations, then the home department has traditionally requested input from industrial relations to the tenure recommendation process. I suspect in recent years this has become more systematic, with full-fledged committees
mm-hmm.
established, who will perhaps go through publications, teaching documents, and then submit some written recommendation to the home department of the individual in question. Job performance as far as industrial relations is concerned, and so that the decision rests with the executive committee of the home department and ultimately the social sciences divisional
mm-hmm.
committee, so that industrial relations, for any of its jointly appointed faculty, industrial relations then plays a minor role,
mm-hmm.
although the greater the level of budgetary appointment, then perhaps the more weight any set of recommendations might carry. But as far as I know, this is, has nothing to do with the dean's compromise after the last effort to departmentalize.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk a little bit about student participation on the various committees. I know that during your administration, they had they were considering whether to allow students to sit on the admissions committee, for example, and I think a compromise was extracted on that in terms of what they could vote on and what they couldn't vote on. Was there any other a discussion around student roles or IRGSA's role in determining the policy or making the decisions on the committee?
The Institute is virtually unique on the Madison campus, and I suspect also in terms of other industrial relations programs around the country, in terms of the extent of formal student participation, and as well of let's say, influence that students have in areas such as curriculum, student admissions, and general operating of the institute itself. Most of this goes back to late 60s, was in part a reflection of the tenor of the times,
mm-hmm.
of student unrest generally, student efforts to increase their participation, their say in the academic community, the university committees, its departments, the world generally. It was part of the creation of the Teaching Assistants Association and the role that the IR students directly played in that. So that the institute it reflected these broader trends, but also perhaps was more open, more amenable to incorporating the trends into the institute and its organization. I think also what reinforced the institute's thought was the creation of the Industrial Relations Graduate Student Association, IRGSA,
mm-hmm.
Which was a sort of main vehicle for IR student activities. In the years before these changes were made, there was very limited participation by faculty in the institute's administration, much less by students, that the executive committee was very small. It tended to function primarily among the econ faculty, and so that participation was broadened out generally, not only for students, but for faculty themselves. And so that as this participation developed, it provided for virtually equal student participation on the curriculum committee, or as they've now become curriculum committees, one for the master's students and one for the PhD students, so that it was much more than just a token student appointed to a single committee. Student representation was appointed to the admissions committee and financial aids committees, but the extent of participation reflected a concern that there were potentially problems of students judging fellow students not only for admissions but for the distribution of financial aid,
mm-hmm.
and so that particularly with regard to financial aid decisions, the student participation in this respect was restricted.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that there is full student participation in the admissions committee. I don't remember what the structure of it is, but students have an equal vote, or have the right to vote. I won't say it's an equal vote, but have the right to vote in the admission of students, and what amounts to virtually an equal vote in the curriculum matters. Students have also been appointed to nearly all of the other institute committees as well. The most difficult committee for student representation was the executive committee,
mm-hmm.
and it was difficult for several reasons. The first of which is that by university legislation, the executive committee is to be limited to tenured faculty, which thereby would preclude not only student participation, but participation by non-tenured or junior faculty, as well as administrative staff. And the as the Institute debated student participation on the executive committee, we were advised by the dean's office that they would not permit, much less approve, student participation on the executive committee, and with the suggestion that if we weren't prepared to run our own by traditional devices, run our own institute, then they would take it over and run it for us. Clear threat.
This was during your directorship, that they.
Yes. So that a compromise was reached, in which initially students were named to the executive committee without a voting role, so that they were permitted to attend the committee meetings. Their input was requested, but they could not officially vote, or at least be counted as voting in the committee meetings. Now, in the years since that was done, an administrative committee was created, which exists in some respects outside of the regular university organizational rules and regulations. The administrative committee functions very much as an executive committee, but it provides a sort of full opportunity for others than tenured faculty to be involved in the decision-making in the institute.
So that would be junior faculty and
junior faculty, students staff, including members of the institute, such as Barbara Dennis, and now Jan Levine Tall, who otherwise would have had no participation in the administration of the institute.
Is this committee, the administrative committee, is it limited to making recommendations on issues which then have to be voted on by the executive committee? I think
as
a lot of other committees function that way.
Yes, the executive committee is the ultimate committee in the institute. Any curriculum change that's proposed must ultimately be approved by the executive committee. Any personnel changes must ultimately be approved by the executive committee. And so that would be true with regard to the functioning of the administrative committee. Whether in fact it does work this way, I guess I can't say for certain. Most of the business seems to go on by means of the administrative committee. But there was, during my tenure as a director, there was not an administrative committee.
I wanted to ask about minority recruitment to the institute, and sort of refresh your memory. One thing that I was looking at was there was discussions over whether to use different or special admission standards for minority students, and this was debated, and there was it was decided that there was would be an appeal to the graduate school to provide funds to for tutoring disadvantaged minority students when they came in, so some sort of remedial help would be provided. And under those circumstances, it would be considered the emission standards could be different or more flexible. And that's the way it was left that I see, that I've seen so far at least. And I wondered what happened to that proposal. And
Amy, do you remember when that proposal was made? Can you put it in some sort of a time perspective? Because I have no recollection of that at the moment. I do not remember this action at all.
Can
question,
you comment more generally
yes.
then on the recruitment of minority students?
Yes. The admissions committee within some general guidelines provided by the executive committee, the institute generally, has pretty much determined on what basis individuals would be admitted to the institute. And as the composition of the committee changes from one year to the next, then differing philosophies, differing points of view may result in differing applications of standards. But it seems to me that at least at one point in time, the question of special standards for minority students was quite controversial, and that there were very differing opinions that came from various groups within the faculty. One which felt that there was an obligation to take, in a sense, affirmative action in recruiting minorities of all kinds, and that if they fell below what had been existing standards, that it was our obligation to give them the means to achieve these standards and to be full-fledged students. And there were others who while they would accept the role of an affirmative recruitment campaign, would rejected the idea that we should enroll below standard, below academic standard, minority students to create, in a sense, a separate class of students. And I think that view pretty much prevailed, and that the committees, with some small difference in application of the standards, has pretty much hewed to the position that the minority students should meet same standards that everyone else does in terms of admission to the program, grading standards while they're in the program, and the fulfillment of the all the degree requirements on their way through the program. And there was general consensus that we needed a much stronger effort to recruit minority students, and in part through working with the other departments in letters and science, primarily economics, which also was debating the same sort of issue. And for a number of years, people such as Glenn Kane, when they were out recruiting minority econ students, also on our behalf attempted to recruit minority IR students. And I think for a time there was some success in this. In recent years, however, for a variety of reasons, numbers of minority students dropped considerably, to the point that there was virtually no minority enrollment in industrial relations. However, this is not isolated to Wisconsin, but We found, in fact, that it occurred nationally, that virtually every other IR program faced the same sort of inability to recruit and retain minority students, and that some different approach was required, so that 1984, with the initiative of Cornell University, a consortium of some 10 industrial relations programs around the country, created a cooperative joint venture called GOALS, Graduate Opportunities for Advanced Level Studies in Industrial Relations, whose function was, first of all, to raise funds for fellowships, to provide financial aid, and then secondly, to assist in the recruitment of minority students. There also was an effort generally to raise the visibility of the field of industrial relations within the minority communities, who in many cases are totally unfamiliar with the field of industrial relations. They may know something about law as a profession, something about business, but but industrial relations is virtually unheard of. But within this joint effort, each individual school would be left to apply their own admission standards, such that whatever standards are applied, for example, at the University of Minnesota, a member of the consortium, may be different from standards applied at Wisconsin or Cornell. And it reflects this debate over what standards are appropriate for admission, as well as for academic progress for minorities. And I think the general consensus that rather than tutoring and remedial action, that there should be no difference in the quality of, at least substantial difference in the quality of those students admitted to the program, minority or non-minority.
This is probably a one or two word answer. I'm curious as to the admission standards for everyone, both the master's and on the PhD level. And I know there would be some difference, but if you could characterize generally whether you thought that not only during your tenure, but over the year, that the because during your tenure, I don't know if you sit on the admissions committee or not, or when you have sat on the admissions committee, but generally whether you feel that the caliber of students has been improving, has been going downhill, and generally during your directorship, what, you know, whether there was a move to tighten up or or make the admission standards more flexible or overall.
Well, I should say first of all that the director or associate director aren't directly involved in the admissions, that this is a function totally of the faculty and students serving on the committees. And if there is any request from an applicant for review of a decision, that this is subject primarily to the committee itself and its considerations. And I guess as I think about the admissions standards and admissions decisions over the 20 years plus that I've been involved in the Institute, I guess in brief, the standards have always been high. Main concern with high quality, well qualified students to be selective in admissions, and to do this for several reasons. One reason would stem from the lack of resources, that there is no way that we could properly deal with a large number of students.
Mm-hmm.
And so that these scarce resources have to be distributed across the students, both through the faculty input as well as to the extent that financial help might be available. So the concern was to limit enrollment,
mm-hmm.
And not take those whom we felt would be merely successful in completing the program,
mm-hmm.
but rather to take those who would reflect well on the program, who not only would complete the program, but complete it with a high level of performance, and as I indicated, would bring credit to the institute, so that the terms of my experience with other programs, on a general basis, our grad students have been certainly on a par with those at Cornell, for example, and considerably higher level of quality than virtually any of the other competing IR programs, such as Illinois or Michigan State or Minnesota,
mm-hmm.
that are. Student body has been small, and it's been a very, very top-notch group.
Mm-hmm.
So that in one respect, this has worked adversely for the program, because
mm-hmm.
Despite the lack of resources, and despite the lack of sort of a concrete physical presence beyond a small collection of offices we have, the graduates of the program have tended to do quite well, to stack up by whatever measures you want and that you want to use. And to the extent we're able to do this, then the argument is, why do you need more money, more facilities, a department, when you already do quite well,
mm-hmm.
and outside reviews of the program have sort of reinforced this view. Our PhD students have outperformed those of any other program, including Cornell's. One of Cornell's current concern, in fact, is the fact that their PhDs, by and large, have been undistinguished, wound up teaching in second-rate institutions with virtually no research record.
Mm-hmm.
And this has not been the case at Wisconsin. And I suppose I should say, despite the efforts of Wisconsin to upgrade the Cornell program by virtue of the number of PhDs we've placed there,
mm-hmm.
Cornell has still not achieved its mark as a in terms of production of high-quality graduate students.
I know that this is something that I'm asking every director, and you can feel free not to answer it. Who besides yourself do you think was the most important director of the institute in terms of their legacy, in terms of their influence on the institute and its policies, its procedures?
Well, I think that there are two individuals who've had a strong impact, and by a hair, I would say, Jerry Summers probably has had the strongest impact and has had the greatest legacy,
mm-hmm.
Both through the time that he was director, but also for the periods before and after that in many respects the Institute came to embody his ideals and his beliefs, his orientations, he in terms of energy, fundraising efforts, and sort of intellectual impact. I don't think there's anyone who had a more significant influence on the Institute than Jerry Summers. Second person would be Jim Stern. And Jim is director at, I think, two crucial periods.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim's impact would be judged differently from Jerry Summers. Jim's impact, I think, would be primarily from his administrative abilities.
Mm-hmm.
Ability to work in particular both with the economics department and the Dean of Letters and Science. Jim initially took over following Jerry Summers at a time in which the Institute and the campus and the field of industrial relations were in a turmoil.
Mm-hmm.
Jim's efforts resulted, at least in his leadership, the Institute's curriculum was changed significantly, and the structure of the Institute changed significantly, and so that when Jim Jones took over, it was a much different set of circumstances from what Jim Stern had inherited from.
Mm-hmm.
From Jerry Summers. Jim also came back at a time in which the Institute had gone through, in a sense, its golden years. It was under great budgetary pressures from the College of Letters and Science. The sort of projected retirement and loss of faculty was now in full swing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that Jim was instrumental in providing transition by which the efforts to recruit new faculty would get launched and to sort of ride out a low point in the Institute. And then I guess as the third person, Lee Hansen, in most recent times, he has built on the foundation that Stern and Summers had laid.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly has worked with the Dean of LNS to recruit new faculty and to do this successfully. So that it's individuals such as that who've made it possible under very precarious circumstances to maintain participation from the departments, maintain resources from the dean, and keep the Institute going, and in a sense to dispute the allegation that the Institute cannot continue to exist.
Mm-hmm.
In its present form. So those three. There are other individuals who at various times, perhaps Robin Fleming in the early days,
mm-hmm.
to get the Institute off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And Reed Tripp, as the Institute had gone out of business as a center.
Mm-hmm.
And had come back again.
Mm-hmm.
To get a degree program funded after it had been no more than a series of sort of short courses and kind of a facilitating operation for different departments on campus. And not to mention individuals such as Everett Caslow and Jack Barbash.
Mm-hmm.
Jack, who rightfully could claim the title sort of Mr. Industrial Relations, University of Wisconsin, the sort of the direct descendant of John R. and although Jack doesn't appear on the list of directors, he certainly is.
I'm going to interview him. So.
Yeah.
I wanted to sort of wind up by asking you what do you think about the future of the study of industrial relations, both at Wisconsin, and I know you've spoken to it already somewhat, and specifically rumblings or rumors that at some time in the future the Institute will be absorbed into the School of Business, and also just in sort of general sense, the future of industrial relations, the study of industrial relations.
Well, I'm very positive, optimistic about both the future generally of the field of industrial relations, and then more specifically, the prospects for not only the existence of, but the growth of the Industrial Relations Research Institute. In the time that I've been here, we've gone through what amounts to almost a complete cycle, in which the beginning of the cycle coincided with the formation of first the center, the sort of crystallization of the field of industrial relations, the concern at the end of World War II with strikes, with collective bargaining, with laborer relations as sort of the field of industrial relations, and then the ebb of that cycle as it lost its glamour, the labor economics itself, and then economics more broadly, moved away from institutional concerns, the applied fields, as they seem to focus on collective bargaining and trade unionism, and students who might otherwise have studied labor relations or labor economics began to look at manpower, at poverty, at international trade or economic development. And it reached a low point maybe in the latter part of the 1960s, early 1970s, and started up again. Some of this is a consequence of the sort of disaffection with, let's say, institutional economics and a very narrow concern with trade unionism and collective bargaining, and the efforts both inside and outside of the field, to give it a firmer theoretical base, to reorient it more empirically, more quantitatively, to bring in working disciplines, not only economics, but sociology, organizational behavior, the international fields, so that industrial relations then has gradually come, although it's still pretty much identified with labor relations and collective bargaining, but has come to mean much more than that, it covers a number of fields, still pretty much in the applied sense, but has a more firmer theoretical and empirical methodological basis to it. It's still pretty much a field that's affected by sort of current events.
Mm-hmm.
A field that's, in a way, newspaper headline hunting.
Mm-hmm.
So that we've moved from labor relations more broadly to poverty and discrimination, affirmative action, and now beyond that into conflict resolution, cooperation, those kinds of issues. I guess I'm encouraged, for example, by changes in the view within the business school to the field of industrial relations to the support that the program is now getting from the dean of the business school, who is very much accepts the industrial relations as a legitimate field, doesn't see it as a rival or as a poor second cousin to other fields in business or economics, and has encouraged management department, in fact, to put more of its efforts into looking at issues like labor management cooperation and conflict resolution. The programs around the country are strong, well entrenched. The Industrial Relations Research Association continues to grow, and in turn its focus has itself broadened from what was strictly collective bargaining to incorporate other fields of industrial relations.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of journals of different kinds that are outlets for research and for writing in the fields. The mainstays continue to be the Cornell Journal and the Berkeley Journal, but in recent years there have been others added. The University of Chicago has a new labor economics journal.
Mm-hmm.
There's a labor research journal. So I went through a period of depression and anxiety feeling that the best days of both the institute and the field were behind us, and that it was more retrenchment in store and the gradual sort of withering away of the field of industrial relations. But I think that's not supported by the trends in the field and the solidity,
mm-hmm.
The foundations of it, so that I'm not about to write it off. I think it's in reasonably good shape. The Institute has hired two new faculty, even though on a joint basis it tends to supply some evidence to support those who say that the Institute can not only survive but prosper.
Mm-hmm.
The people it's hired in recent years on a joint basis in economics, in history, in sociology, sort of meet the standards of their fields as being strong people, not second-class citizens, so that they, in a different way, will contribute to the Institute and keep it going. So I'm, as I say, very positive, very optimistic, both generally and specifically.
I don't have any other questions. I wanted to know if you wanted to say anything else on the record before I turn off the machine.
Well, I might have an addendum at some future point, and I'll reserve my right for a rebuttal or a reply, but at the moment I don't have anything further, no.
Okay. I'm going to turn the machine off.